dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. I am delighted to be able to present to you several very interesting folks in the battle space of the war for the free world, as I think of it. We'll jump into it with each of them in turn, and I will introduce them accordingly. But I'm going to start right in, because we have very little time to discuss a lot going on in the Middle East, with our friend Dr. Barry Rubin, who is a professor at the Interdisciplinary Center at Herzliya, also the director of the Global Research in International Affairs Center of that center, better known as Gloria. He is an author of seemingly countless books, including some that are directly relevant to the topics we want to visit with him about today, including Syria and the Muslim Brotherhood. Barry, I just wanted to start, though, with the piece that you wrote in the Jerusalem Post very recently that talks about basically the United States, or the free world more generally, being saved by our enemies. Tell us about your thesis in that piece, and whether we can have confidence that our enemies will continue to pull our chestnuts out of the fire.
Well, let us define two potential enemies, types of enemies. One is very smart at maneuvering, ready to hide permanently their extremism, ready to compromise in order to get a stronger position. If that was the case, we'd be in a lot more trouble. In fact, there are people who can hide their views a bit, but even when covered in the media, their true views soon come out for some reasons. We'd go into him more time. They don't compromise. They want everything. They get heady with victory. They demand too much. And then they basically force you to fight them. And that's the way that the PLO and Fatah and Hamas and Hezbollah and now the Muslim Brotherhood are behaving. They just can't keep up the pretense, and they really look for that total victory that they believe is coming to them. Iran refused to compromise on nuclear, even though they were offered really good deals. Syria refused to go west, even when offered a lot. Fatah and the Palestinians refused a state, and the Muslim Brotherhood is increasingly and will increasingly come out with a clearly radical stance. So, therefore, we learn the lesson. Even the people who don't want to have to respond to it.
Yeah, let me just ask you, because I think that's a very interesting assessment of what we're dealing with. To what extent does that kind of behavior really reflect kind of the doctrine, I think of it as Sharia, that essentially says when your enemies, the infidels specifically, are submitting to you, you must redouble the effort to make them feel subdued. That, you know, in effect, we're drawing them out.
You assume you're going to win because God's on your side. But there are also much more political things, like you have to signal what to believe to your followers. You have to be properly militant, because otherwise your rivals will take advantage of it. So there are a number of political as well as ideological factors. And right now, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood is faced with a perfect example of this kind of choice. As you know, they won the parliamentary elections, and now a president is supposed to be elected. It's been announced the campaign will start on March the 10th, and they have to make a big decision. Option A is they are going to unofficially they're going to back a candidate who might win, and we could end up in a situation. People talk about elections being held in June, although it's not 100% sure. We could end up in a situation in which the Brotherhood candidate is running against the Salafist, the even more extreme candidate, in an election. So So they have to decide, and the decision is this. Are they going to cool it, wait up to 4 years, pull back, and let a non-Islamist be elected president, or are they going to become drunk with the victory and push to help one of their people, even though nominally independent, elected president, and proceed much faster with his nomination of Egypt? I think we'll know the answer to that in about a month.
Okay. Well, we'll be following it closely with you, Dr. Barry Rubin. Speaking of Egypt, over the weekend there was a poll that was included in a report in the Wall Street Journal conducted by Gallup that found that the overwhelming attitude of the Egyptian people is that they want jobs, not Sharia law. They voted, it seems, otherwise. Yeah. Well, let's get into the sort of psychology here, if we can, as to how you see where the Egyptian people really are on this Islamicization business.
Well, I mean, not everybody who voted for the Muslim Brotherhood wants an Islamic Egypt. I would estimate that about 25% of their voters voted for them because they thought they would be, you know, more effective. That's about, say, 12-15% of the population. Sure, but remember, we have seen a persistent pattern in the Middle East, and the pattern is when the economy is a mess, when things aren't going well, then you turn to demagoguery against the West, against Israel, and this pattern has worked in the past. So, but you know, the Westerners must insist that everybody is always driven by materialistic aspirations. And, of course, Ayatollah Khomeini said the Iranian Revolution wasn't about the price of watermelons. Bill Clinton just said that the reason you have terrorism is because people are poor. And, in fact, the son of the richest man in Nigeria became an anti-American terrorist, one of the richest men in Nigeria. So you just cannot explain all of this through materialistic explanations. Ideology is important. We saw it in communism, we saw it in fascism, and we see it in Arab nationalism, we see it in Islamism.
Yeah, but it does seem to me, and Dr. Barry Rubin, you've literally written the book about the Muslim Brotherhood, that what they're good at is figuring out how to try, at least up to the point where, again, they feel they can safely expose their true intentions to couch them, and that we're seeing what the journal called a charm offensive at the moment to try to get some foreign investment, this IMF loan, and other kinds of bailouts coming their way.
Ah, but here we have right in front of us right now, we were told that Egypt would never become anti-American, they wouldn't go too far because they wanted to get the U.S. aid. And here we have a situation in which on February 26th, the Egyptians are going to put a half dozen Americans, including the son of a cabinet member, on trial as criminals for helping NGOs. So if, in fact, they are totally motivated by aid, why are they taking this risk? Now, of course, one reason is the Obama administration is weak, and they can get away with it. But it shows that political power, popularity, and so on is more important than material gain. Consider one simple fact. The Obama administration is putting together a package of $800 million in aid for the, quote, Arab Spring, and quote, countries. Most of that's for Egypt, at a time when Americans are essentially being held hostage in Egypt. Now, any previous government would have suspended it. They would have said, we're not going to talk about any more aid unless these people are released. Use it as leverage. That's another example of how this president is so totally different from all the Democrats and Republicans who have come before him. So, yes, they know Obama is weak and they'll take advantage of it. But, again, if they're motivated by materialistic explanations, why don't they let these people go? It won't cost them anything to let them go. And why are they risking all the U.S. aid? So over and over again, we see people behave differently from those materialistic explanations.
Yeah, no, I'm very much with you. I think there are other things animating them. But I do think that the calculation that they can both play to their base, if you will, by being anti-American and still expect to extract, the last count I saw, it's something like $1.3 billion for Egypt.
That's the regular aid.
And then there's another $770 million, as I understand it, that's supposed to go to some sort of incentive program. So we'll be watching all of this closely with you, I hope, Barry Rubin, and I appreciate very much your analysis and commentary. We didn't get to Syria today, but there's a lot happening there. We'll look forward to having you back very soon, if we may, to visit about that and where you think the various competing dynamics are at work, aid, materialism, and doctrine, all in the mix in terms of the future of the Syrian regime and what may come next, perhaps the Muslim Brotherhood there too. Barry Rubin, again, thank you so much for joining us.
First line of defense in the war of ideas, Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Nuclear inspectors are back in Iran. As Yogi Berra famously said, it feels like deja vu all over again. That's because this is the umpteenth time international monitors have tried to get the Iranians to admit the purpose of their program is to get nuclear weapons, not nuclear power. It won't happen this time either. At best, the inspectors will see only what the mullahs intend, which will be nothing instructive. More likely, the representatives of the so-called international community will be humiliated again, and Tehran will be that much closer to getting the bomb. At this point, more talk and useless inspections merely increase the threat posed to Israel and to us. The only hope for preventing calamity is military action. Given the stakes, it better be ours, not just Israel's. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
This could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Mark Jembecki. He is the Chief Information Officer and a national security surrogate for Newt Gingrich's 2012 presidential campaign. He is a man who has worked in the vineyards of national security for quite some time, including as an executive at Deloitte Touche. He is a man who has brought to us War Room Research and a book entitled The War Room Guide to Competitive Intelligence. Mark, it's terrific to have you with us. We are admirers of Speaker Gingrich and have had the privilege of talking with him from time to time on this program, and you are an admirable surrogate for him. So welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
Let me just start with sort of the, I guess, the threshold question, and that is we are told by certainly President Obama's campaign and handlers and admirers that that the president is essentially invulnerable on the national security portfolio, having successfully taken out Osama bin Laden and Anwar al-Awlaki and a number of other wanted al-Qaeda leaders. You presumably think differently. If so, tell us why.
Well, I don't think that President Obama is invulnerable from a national security standpoint, as well as several other platforms and issues that that he has stepped in over the past couple of years, predominantly because, for example, if you take a look at the terrorism issue with Osama bin Laden, that was an intelligence network that was set up years ago. It's taken a while to identify and then confront the target. So just because President Obama was the man on watch when it happened, I don't think it makes him invulnerable. Another aspect is our whole cybersecurity defense apparatus in the United States is not as well off as it should be. I've worked for two presidents, Clinton and Bush, on that, and I can tell you from firsthand being in the White House that President Obama can do a much better job with cybersecurity. There seems to be a roadblock in the sharing of information. And if you take a look at things like SOPA, the Stop Online Privacy Act,
right.
It was just a silly thing to even push forward. And it showed me very, very clearly how connected he is to Hollywood. And we have existing laws and regulations in place that will protect the intellectual property and copyright. But he wanted to push it a little bit further. And so I certainly don't think he's invulnerable. Speaker Gingrich is by far one of the most brilliant politicians we've had in this country over the last 100 years. And I think from a national security standpoint and a technology standpoint, he's the guy to beat.
Yeah. Let's drill down just a little bit on that cyber business, because recently, as you know, we had the Chinese vice president and presumptive next leader of Communist China touring the United States. And the day he arrived for his red carpet treatment at the White House, the Wall Street Journal broke a story that was quite troubling to, I think, this layman, and I assume to even experts like yourself, Mark and Bickey, namely that we had a major U.S. telecommunications company, Nortel Networks, penetrated for over a decade by Chinese hackers, presumably working for and with the government of China, that may have contributed both to the demise of that company and perhaps as a result of it spinning off parts of the company to other American enterprises, perhaps the penetration of those as well. What does that tell you, not only about the sort of military cyber threat, but the commercial cyber threat, and what we best be doing about it?
Okay, well, let's break that down. First of all, let's the whole Nortel situation is quite interesting from two dimensions. The first is the immediate reaction, as you just pointed out, is that the Chinese got in, the theft of intellectual property, how they could be exploiting the information. But let's also take a look at the flip side of that. We have brilliant men and women in this country and the best intelligence network in the world. So I would bet that many of our national assets, our operators, our quiet professionals knew that that was going on, and they provided adequate defenses, and maybe we fed the Chinese information that they wanted to hear. So there's always a flip side to it. Just because somebody gets broken into doesn't necessarily mean that it wasn't an unwanted attack. Cybersecurity is very much information warfare, how you mislead people, how you run them, how you get them to do what you want them to do. So I have a hard time believing that our intelligence networks and even private contractors who are very loyal to the United States didn't know that that was going on. And I would bet that China didn't get away with all too much.
Wow. Well, look, from your lips to God's ears, it sure didn't sound like that from the reporting. And maybe that's right. Maybe it's wrong. But it seemed to me, Mark, that what this was suggestive of was a long-running operation that both suggests the determination of the Chinese to use cyber for both
right.
espionage as well as, well, effectively for warfare purposes. And
Gosh, I hope you're right that we were all over it and blunting it, but it sounded as though the company for sure didn't know what it was up against until fairly recently, and may not have come fully clean with some of its purchasers of its parts. Let me ask you, one of the things that I've been impressed by in terms of Newt Gingrich's public campaign, Mark Jimbecki, who again is the chief information officer for that campaign and also a national security surrogate for Speaker Gingrich, is the clarity with which the speaker has spoken of Sharia as a totalitarian ideology that is animating jihadism. This really seems like one of the areas in which there's the starkest contrast between himself and his vision of national security at the moment and the Obama administration, which can't bring itself even to mention jihad or Islam or Sharia or anything else that might be contributing to what it now euphemistically calls countering violent extremism. I wonder if you might comment on where Speaker Gingrich gets this clarity and how important you think it is that we actually speak truthfully about this threat.
Well, I think speaking truthfully about it is a start. You must have some type of polar view when it comes to Sharia law. You must reject it. An ideology, a belief system, a belief window, if you will, you know, we wake up every day and we look at our lives as a patriot, a father, a brother, whatever it may be. You take that belief window and you amp it up, and now you've got people that will absolutely do anything to hurt this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very important that we understand their view, how they look at us, and it's zero and one. It's polar. It's either black or white. And
binary.
I think it's very, very, very important.
Yeah, Mark. Speaking of this, you've spent time in the intelligence business. I just wonder. We've been told as recently as last week that Federal Bureau of Investigations Director Robert Mueller was meeting with a bunch of folks who have been associated with the Muslim Brotherhood's various front organizations in the United States. And at the meeting, he proudly declared that the FBI had purged something like 700 documents and 300 presentations from its files. I don't know if this is altogether true, but unfortunately, I'm afraid it sounds right. Just very quickly, in a minute or so we have left, how would Speaker Gingrich approach the insistence that we stop talking about things that might offend Muslims?
He's not concerned as much. Let me back up. He is concerned about people being offended if things are well documented and there's basis. The speaker does not like to run on rumor or innuendo. In this particular example, I don't have all the facts, and no one on the campaign would want to support any type of rumor or innuendo about it. I mean, his operating philosophy is you try to collect as many of the facts as you can, and you dig deep in yourself for the leadership. You make the decision, you leave the country, and that's certainly something that's missing in the White House right now.
That's for sure. Mark Jimbecki, thank you very much for joining us. We have to let you go. We will look forward to visiting with you, I hope, in the future, and best of luck on the campaign trail. Next up, my colleague Fred Grandy goes inside the cloakroom with one of America's most courageous, Congresswoman Sue Myrick. Straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. a fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
Following is an important message from President Clinton and President Bush.
In January, Haiti experienced an environmental catastrophe and human tragedy of epic proportion.
But thanks in part to the generous spirit of the American people, the country of Haiti has survived. But now the people need to thrive. President Clinton and I have seen firsthand the power of your contributions at work.
The Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund is on the ground, funding programs that create jobs, teach skills, and assist local businesses.
Our fund is dedicated to supporting initiatives that encourage local entrepreneurs and help build an inclusive economy that lifts up everyone.
Help us continue this work so the people of Haiti have an opportunity to prosper.
Thank you.
To donate, go to ClintonBushHaitiFund.org or text QUAKE to 20222 to give $10. Message and data rates may apply. Brought to you by the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy with you in the cloakroom, and we are pleased to welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio Congresswoman Sue Myrick, who has represented the state of North Carolina. For the last 18 years, she serves on the Energy and Commerce Committee, the Intelligence Committee, and has been the chair of the Anti-Terrorism Caucus in the House of Representatives. Congressman Myrick, thanks for being with us.
Well, you're welcome.
I wanted to get right into the whole situation with Iran, which I'm sure your colleagues on the Intelligence Committee are watching very carefully and cautiously. Apparently, you have IAEA inspectors in Iran right now. But as a member of the committee, as you watch this, does this appear to be a serious discussion between the West and Iran, or do you think the Iranians are just buying time?
Well, I think they're buying time, very frankly. I mean, you know, every time something gets close that it looks like it's going to cause them a problem, then, you know, they come up with, well, we'll let an inspector in, or we'll do this, or we'll do that. And I just don't think it's going to make any difference. I really don't. They're just going to continue with what they're doing and laugh at us behind our back.
So I guess that's a way of saying that you believe that they are developing some kind of nuclear weaponry.
Well, I think they're on their way to doing that, yes.
And what about sanctions? Obviously, we've got new sanctions this time. The central bank is involved. Do you think they will have any effect, or is that just another delaying tactic as well?
Well, no, actually, this time the sanctions have, because other countries have gotten involved, and with the central bank, we have really put a crimp in what they can do. And, of course, a lot of people say, well, they're coming forward because we have put such a crimp in their economy with the sanctions that are currently on. So the sanctions at this point, when they did the banking sanctions, really made a difference. However, we've got Russia and China who are going to continue to trade with them, as you well know. They buy their oil, et cetera, et cetera. So they still have that market. But the Europeans have joined us, unfortunately, with some tough sanctions, and that's helped tremendously. It's not, you know, it's not going to stop them, but at least it has slowed them down.
Well, I see the Iranians are retaliating against, it looks to be, at least England and France, by cutting off oil supplies. How do you think that plays into this scenario?
Well, I can't speak for what the Europeans will do. I just know that anything that that we can do to keep the pressure on Iran, we need to do. And my concern has always been they're going to continue to do what they're doing regardless, because they basically have been able to get away with it in the past.
Well, then let me ask you the obvious question here involving Israel. What is their next move? Would you expect Israel to make a preemptive strike against nuclear facilities in Iran, or are they playing the waiting game too?
Well, I don't think anyone wants to see what could be a war in the Mideast again. But I can tell you that Israel will do what they need to do to protect themselves. And they aren't going to sit and wait until it's too late and Iran has adapted or actually has a nuclear weapon before they take some kind of action. Now, what that action is, I don't know. And, of course, I do have to be a little careful about what I say, Fred, because I am on intelligence.
Sure, so. Yeah, I understand. I just wanted to ask, as far as Israel is concerned, do you expect them to involve themselves in any kind of negotiations, or are they going to wait for us in terms of trying to talk Iran off this ledge?
Well, it's a good question, because Iran does not want to negotiate with Israel. I mean, you know, they've made that pretty clear in most cases. Now, if they come forward and say they're willing to have them at the table, that's another story. But, you know, I'm sure you've been to Israel, and
sure.
It's in a very precarious situation. And, you know, they won't exist as a country if Iran gets nuclear weapons, because everybody knows their intent. So, you know, they've got to protect themselves and their people and sovereignty of their country, Fred.
Okay, well, then let's turn to another delicate situation, Congresswoman, and that, of course, is what is unfolding in Egypt right now. The Muslim Brotherhood appears to have about 75% of the new parliament. You know very well that NGOs have been raided. We have American hostages now apparently being held by the Egyptian military. Just who should we trust over there as this government unfolds? And has democracy been derailed, in your view?
I think it has. I really do. You know, they say they're going to be moderate, but, you know, they have not given up Sharia law. Sharia law is the basis of everything. Sharia law still says a man can beat his wife, woman doesn't have any rights, on and on and on. You know all that.
Sure, absolutely.
So they aren't going to get away from that. They say they're going to rule by Islamic law. Well, I mean, come on. And it really irritates me because, you know, we have said, and I know the chairwoman of the committee that's in charge of the appropriations over that 1.3, I think it is, billion aid that we give Egypt, they're not getting a penny. They don't care.
We've actually had Kay Granger on the show, who chairs the Foreign Operations Subcommittee, and she's said as much and done as much. But, of course, you know the president has added the $1.5 billion back into his budget, plus included another $800 million of what he calls supplemental aid to Arab Spring countries. What will Congress's reaction be to that, do you think?
I understand that, Fred, but you were there. You know that Congress controls the purse strings, not the president.
And you feel strongly that your colleagues will not let that money flow unless you have assurances that there is at least the beginnings of some kind of democratic majority in Egypt?
At this point, I do, yes, because people are very upset about the fact that they have Americans actually going to try them. You know, over in the Mideast, you saw the Saddam Hussein trial. They bring people to trial in a cage. I mean, talk about inhumane. They are in the dark ages.
You're absolutely right, Congressman. That brings me to my last topic. You have been one of the foremost spokespeople and critics of Sharia law and the problems with it, particularly as it begins to take shape in the Arab world. I want to ask you about some of the problems in this country right now. The Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice apparently is promulgating new rules on intelligence that will not even allow intelligence officials to use terms like jihad and Sharia and radical Islam, terms the enemy used to describe themselves. What can you, as members of Congress, do perhaps to prevent this from becoming the new prevailing standard in counterintelligence?
Well, Fred, it also includes DOD. We have, the Department of Defense, we have been working on this for quite some time, and through the Homeland Security Department, and not getting anywhere other than, you know, being able to have some input on, not input, but some insight on what they are doing when they have the meetings. Right now we have a letter outstanding that we wrote in December to Eric Holder and Leon Panetta, who's the new Secretary of Defense, and asking them, you know, that we wanted to find out what their criteria is. You know, what is it that they're doing? How are they making these decisions, et cetera? And very frankly, we are getting stonewalled. They just basically responded once to our letter and saying that they would give us a briefing on the matter once the reviews were completed. Well, you know, the timeline is definite because there's always going to be new lectures, new professors to review, and not to mention threat changes that are going to occur. And so they won't give us anything, and they won't give anything to the staff of the Armed Services Committee, who has also requested this out of DOD. So this is through a formal request. So I'm going to personally call Secretary Panetta. I got to know him well on intelligence when he was head of the CIA, and demand an answer, because this is absolutely ridiculous.
You know, this reminds me of a conversation we had a couple of years ago in another radio program, where you were having the same frustrations with Secretary Napolitano trying to get some answers about Hezbollah in Latin America. I have to ask you, Congresswoman, is this one of the reasons that after 18 years of service, you're beginning to say, maybe I don't want to do this anymore, because of the tendency for stonewalling that's certainly been prevalent in this administration on intelligence issues?
Well, no, it doesn't have anything to do with it, Fred, from the standpoint that I still hope to be involved in some way in some of these issues. You know, I feel so strongly about it, and I'm not going to give up. You know, they're now saying there's evidence that Ebola is in South America and Central America and so forth, you know, even though they tried to laugh me out of town because I said that this was the case. I mean, give me a break. So, you know, we're going to continue to fight this. I'm here till the end of December, and I'm already mentoring some people who are interested in these issues to take over when I'm no longer here, because we're going to continue. This is not going to end. They're not going to just get away with this and expect all of us to roll over and play dead. I mean, this is too important to our country, and you cannot educate people who are dealing with radical Islamist ideology. You cannot tell them what it's like unless you use the terminology they use themselves.
That's absolutely true.
It's stupid.
Yeah, Congressman, I can't tell you how encouraging that is to hear, and how disappointed we are that you are going to be leaving Congress. But as long as you're be here till next December, at least we have somebody to work with. That's Congressman Sue Myrick, who has been with us on the Cloakroom. Frank will be back with Gordon Chang in just a minute.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medications, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the Meta System. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show. Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say
sweater?
That?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our regular engagement with our friend Gordon Chang of Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com. He is a man frequently asked to provide insights into what is going on in Asia and what it means for us. By, among others, Fox News, and it's always a privilege to have him with us, as we do each week here at Secure Freedom Radio. Gordon, welcome back. We've got a chance now to do a post-mortem on something that was just beginning when we last spoke, namely the visit by Xi Jinping of China, the prospective next leader there, and we'll talk about his prospects in a moment. But very quickly, what's your sense of how he did and how he was received and whether it was the right kind of response?
we had essentially a three-leg tour, Washington, Iowa, Los Angeles, with Xi Jinping, who was expected to become the next general party secretary, in other words, the next Chinese leader, sometime at the end of this year. And it was more like a get-to-know-you tour, and so there was really not that much of substance to the trip. But the one thing that was really striking was that he got a 19-gun salute at the Pentagon. We have never given such an honor to a foreign vice president arriving in the United States, and we should not have given it to someone from China. If we were going to do it at all, it should have been an ally and a friend. This was really just wrong.
Symbolic, presumably, of the administration's keen interest in improving the military-to-military aspects of our relationship, but probably sending the wrong signal in the process. Gordon, did you have a chance to reflect on something that struck me as another very discordant note? And I'm not suggesting that the timing of this was the administration's, but in the course of Jing's travels, we had the Associated Press, I believe, break the story that the Obama administration was actively considering a reduction of something on the order of 80% of the U.S. nuclear deterrent, quite possibly unilaterally. And knowing what you know of China, knowing what you know, among other things, or at least what any of us can know about what they seem to be doing in terms of their own nuclear buildup, how do you think this revelation was taken by the Chinese?
Well, I'm sure they see this as another aspect of what they perceive to be American decline. This is just awful policy. Whatever one thinks of disarmament, you can't do this unless you get all the parties in the room to disarm at the same time. And right now, the Chinese refuse to be a party to any of these discussions on the reduction of nuclear weapons. We don't know how many weapons they have. They could have as few as 400, or as the Georgetown project showed us, they could have as many as 3,000. This is important because we've already agreed to reduce our warheads, operational warheads, to 1,550. And if we reduce it beyond that, we put ourselves at a very important disadvantage with regard to the Chinese. This is just cannot be done.
Yeah. Well, it certainly confers on them, one would assume, superpower status, which, as you understand better than most of us, Gordon Chang, is almost certainly going to be problematic. Speaking of problematic, let me just ask quickly about something that that also came out last week in the course of Xi's travels, namely a report that the Chinese hackers, presumably working for and with the government, were inside the computers and information systems of a major telecommunications firm, Nortel Networks, in the United States for as long as a decade. I was just speaking in the segment before yours with Mark Gimbecki of the Gingrich campaign, and he took a fairly I guess it's fair to say, relaxed view of this on the assumption that the U.S. cyber warriors were aware of what was going on here and perhaps feeding back bad information. It certainly didn't read that way to me in the journal's account. Maybe they got it right, maybe they don't. But, Gordon, again, is there anything surprising about the fact that the Chinese are engaging in this kind of cyber warfare against our private sector entities as well as our government? And to the extent that this kind of thing clearly is troubling, I think, what would the Chinese make of the fact that nobody seemed to be terribly upset about it?
The Chinese must be absolutely bewildered, because China's cyber warfare campaign, and it's not just against the Defense Department and American defense contractors, it's against countries all across the world. This is a really an important and critical threat, and it threatens every weapon system that we have, because if they can disable our computers, they have an enormous advantage in a conflict situation. So I don't know how we could be relaxed about any of this, and I don't think that the United States actually understood the extent of the penetration of Nortel and other companies. So this is something that we really have to work on over time. And clearly the Pentagon is starting to think about this, of course, but we need to do much more because we cannot field a weapon system if the Chinese have all of our computer codes and can disable all the weapons that we have.
Yeah, that may sound like an exaggeration, but the extent of this particular penetration suggests otherwise. And to the extent, as we talked about, that Nortel may wittingly or presumably unwittingly, have allowed other American companies to buy parts of that company with perhaps Chinese trap doors in their computers is a very worrying thing indeed. Gordon, we don't have a whole lot of time, but another very important topic that you've addressed recently in your World Affairs Journal column, I believe, was the power struggle going on in China. Even as Xi is here in the United States, there was some high drama back home. Give us a quick readout on what happened and what to make of it.
A top-level official in Chongqing, which is perhaps the largest city in the world, tried to defect to the American consulate in Chengdu in neighboring Sichuan province. The party boss of Chongqing, a guy named Bo Xilai, actually sent what was essentially an army of security troops who were armed into a neighboring province to try to retrieve this official, Wang Lijun. We think our politics are corrosive and dysfunctional. The Chinese are actually engaging in much worse at this point. But what we decided to do, the United States, was not to give asylum to this official. And that is going to have to be something that we'll think about because this has important implications for our relations with China and for Chinese stability. So this is an important thing that people in Congress are looking at. And I think the State Department has a lot of questions to answer about not granting asylum.
Do you have any sense of why it was that they didn't give asylum? And you said something interesting to me a moment ago about how it may actually be destabilizing to China that we turn them back over to their tender mercies.
Most people think that we did not grant asylum to Wang Lijun because we did not want to roil relations with Beijing on the eve of Xi Jinping's visit to Washington. By not granting asylum, we did a number of things. One of them is we persuaded Chinese officials not to try to contact us and give us documents, as Wang tried to do. And so, in a sense, we bolstered the Chinese regime by refusing asylum. On the other hand, it may work out that by not granting asylum, Wang had to turn over the documents to Beijing, which would further their own internal power struggle, which could even be more destabilizing. But nonetheless, we need to have this conversation in Washington.
Yeah. And Gordon, just a little bit of background on this this fellow Bo and how he relates to a kind of dynamic between the so-called princeling group and the Communist Youth League group and where the military fits in all of this. All of that in a minute, please.
Okay. Bo Xilai is a princeling, as is Xi Jinping, presumably the next leader. Hu Jintao is a member of the Communist Youth League faction. They're all fighting among each other, and by many accounts, this is going to undermine Xi Jinping's path to power. This is going to be very important. Bo Xilai has tried to get the military involved in this power struggle, which means, you know, if the military becomes even more influential in China, we really have to watch out.
Yeah. Well, we will be watching carefully and listening at greater length. Do you describe and help explain, really, what's going on there? Gordon Chang, as always, we appreciate your insights enormously. Thanks for the work that you do here each week and also, of course, the contributions you've made through your published writings, like The Coming Collapse of China, and also, of course, your columns at Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com. We'll look forward, as I say, to another visit next week this time. And for the rest of you, we look forward to talking to with you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Have a great President's Holiday.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.